Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to resume with the penultimate session of the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, a book put together by the researchers at the Nation of Islam. And I encourage you to go ahead and buy the book there if you want to learn more about this, read the footnotes, which are copious. They're well into the four figures. It's number three in their series, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. The first two document Jewish domination of the slave trade and then Jewish domination of the agricultural industry. So it kind of traces the entire history of blacks in America in relation to Jews. Jews bring them over. Jews own a lot of plantations. They dominate the agricultural produce sections that the blacks produce, cotton and such, and they're completely integrated, the Jews, into the Old South. They support Jim Crow even after the war. They supported white supremacy before the war, but it all changed with the Leo Frank case, and that's what we've been hearing about in the last sessions that we've done so far, probably 10, 12. And now we're going to conclude the cross-examination of Leo Frank, which will only leave us what Leo Frank represents as our last session. So today we'll do, this is probably closer to 30 pages, for 35 to through 464, so 29 pages to end, as I say, the cross-examination of Leo Frank. Begins with the subsection, Alonzo Mann in the Leo Frank quote, pardon, unquote. Epigraph, you can't reverse an 80-year-old conviction based on the wavering memory of an 85-year-old man, says Jew Steve Oney, who we heard lying last session. Turned a ball of twine into knitting yarn, essentially. In 1915, Governor John Slayton of Georgia would not deploy the power of his office to pardon Leo Frank, even though he claimed to be convinced of his innocence. He chose to commute Frank's sentence from death to life imprisonment, both being legally appropriate sentences for first-degree murder. It took 68 years from the time of Slayton's official action before the friends and supporters of the Leo Frank legend reappeared to finish the task in seeking a full pardon for their man. Their first attempt in 1983 was denied by the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles, but in 1985, the Jewish community began working secretly with the board to prepare what it called a posthumous pardon, direct quote, of Leo Frank. The five-member board allowed no other testimony or input from the family of Mary Fagan, James Conley, Hugh Dorsey, or any other interested party. Isn't that amazing? I mean, so their guy rapes and tortures and kills a young girl, and then 85 years, you know, 65 years after the fact, they're still trying to mess with the outcome. And they don't even allow her relatives or the prosecutor's relatives or one of the blacks they tried to frame to testify at the parole hearing. I mean, it just goes to show, as I've been saying all along, the main takeaway of this is the Leo Frank affair is a perfect microcosm of Jew attitudes and Jewish racial behavior all through history. They are truly best summed up as the people of the lie. Again, the five-member board allowed no other testimony or input from the family of Mary Fagan, James Conley, Hugh Dorsey, or any other interested party. And on March 11, 1986, the body announced its unprecedented action to the public. Quote, without attempting to address the question of guilt or innocence, and in recognition of the state's failure to protect the person of Leo M. Frank, and thereby preserve his opportunity for continued legal appeal of his conviction. He went through 13 courts and was found guilty every time. And in recognition of the state's failure to bring his killers to justice, and as an effort to heal old wounds, the State Board of Pardons and Paroles, in compliance with its constitutional and statutory authority, hereby grants to Leo M. Frank a pardon. The board's action was certainly unprecedented and possibly illegal, given that the first pardon attempt just 3 years earlier was rejected explicitly because of a lack of evidence. Quote, for the board to grant such a pardon, the innocence of the subject must be shown conclusively. In the board's opinion, this has not been shown. In effect, the Board of Pardons and Paroles flouted its own mandate and ignored its own criteria in order to reverse its decision without establishing Frank's innocence. Indeed, the pardon has to do with actions or inactions of the state of Georgia and does not acknowledge any crime for which a pardon is necessary. Further, according to Georgia statutes, it is not clear that a dead convicted felon who has not served out his sentence can be pardoned. The entire episode provides yet another example of the raw force wielded by Jewish organizations to achieve a symbolic redemption for one of their own. Next section, Alonzo Mann pardons Leo Frank. It is the first failed attempt to exonerate Leo Frank in 1982 that provides a significant new chapter in the analysis of the 1913 murder of Mary Fagan. Charles Wittenstein, or Wittenstein, as it sounds, Southern Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, and attorney Dale M. Schwartz, an ADL National Board member, spearheaded the campaign and claimed to have found new explosive evidence that finally, quote, solved, unquote, the murder of Mary Fagan. That evidence appeared in the person of 83-year-old Alonzo, quote, Lonnie Mann, who, as a 13-year-old boy, worked at the National Pencil Company factory on the day of the murder as Frank's assistant office boy. Mann had reemerged after 69 years of total silence to reveal a remarkable secret that his conscience had finally demanded that he hold no longer. He was now claiming that on April 26, 1913, the day of the murder of Mary Fagan, he had entered the factory and surprised James Conley carrying the girl's body at the foot of the first floor stairway. Mann said that Conley saw him and threatened his life if he ever told anyone what he had seen. Mann went home and told his parents, who swore him to secrecy about his experience. In fact, Alonzo Mann, who died in 1985, kept his experience quiet long after his parents had died, but with his own death approaching, he finally wanted to set the record straight and make his story known. Alonzo Mann's astonishing revelation was featured in Nashville's Tennessean newspaper, which, on March 7, 1982, devoted an entire Sunday section to Mann's tale, titled, An Innocent Man Was Lynched. In its multi-article spread, Alonzo Mann's story was presented as the final resolution, the be-all and end-all, the smoking gun of the Mary Fagan murder case. The Tennessean's team of crack journalists, led by Jerry Thompson and Robert Sherborne, and its publisher, John Siegenthaler, were assisted by the state librarian and a polygraph technician, and with this single Sunday issue, the Tennessean set about to accomplish what all of Leo Frank's lawyers, Adolf Ochs's New York Times, and William J. Burns's detectives could not. The exoneration of, quote, the Jew, unquote, Leo Frank, and the conviction of, quote, the real killer, the Negro James Conley. But despite the Tennessean's pretense of skilled and balanced journalism, there are serious flaws in its promotion and handling of the Alonzo Mann story that call into question the newspaper's very credibility. And it starts with the Tennessean building the false impression that Mann's story had been legally tested, when in fact Mann was never questioned or challenged in any judicial forum. For example, the paper refers to Mann's passing a lie detector test, and a photo depicts Mann strapped to a polygraph machine, but there is no known recording or transcript of that examination or test results available for scholars to analyze independently. All other documents related to the pardon are for some unknown reason considered a confidential state secret and not subject to release under the Open Records Act. During the frenzied publicity tour that surrounded the Tennessean spread, Mann gave interviews in which he claimed to know Conley's motive and the intimate details of his life. Steve Oney quoted Mann thus, I know why he, Conley, had the girl, too. He wanted her money. Jim Conley was a smart nigger. He could talk to you and had a personality you would like. But he drank all the time, and he had women in there. He was drinking that morning. Tennessean reporters did not ask Mann how he could have known the details of Conley's character and factory practices, for the boy had been just hired April 1, 1913, and only worked 2 Saturdays before the murder. Yet he spoke of Conley as if the two had had a long-term intimate association. And the more Alonzo Mann talked about his 69-year-old experience, the less it could be synchronized with the known facts of the case, and, indeed, with his own previous versions of the story. Steve Oney, deemed an, quote, expert on the case by the ADL, had to conclude that Mann's, quote, confession was, quote, incredibly dramatic, but, quote, added little of probative value. Alonzo Mann's unbelievable beliefs. A closer look at Mann's new testimony justifies Oney's polite rebuff. After many decades of rumination over his role in the episode, the elderly man seems to have conflated his own 1913 memories with the many published accounts of the Leo Frank affair to create, in 1982, an impossible scenario. To start, in 1913, Mann testified under oath that he, quote, did not know Mary Fagan even by sight. By 1982, Mann was telling a tale of having seen Mary at the factory riding in a little red wagon and laughing along with another girl employee. Nearly 70 years later, he now was claiming to have known her both by name and by sight. In his 1982 affidavit in quotes, because it's not a real one, Mann makes the following statement about his appearance at the trial. Quote, I was nervous and afraid that day. There were crowds in the street who were angry and who were saying that Leo Frank should die. Some were yelling things like, kill the Jew. So Alonzo Mann, who is not a Jew, is either confused or lying. Though this kill the Jew statement has been published many times, the claim has been thoroughly debunked and has now been quietly dropped from all the latest pro-Frank accounts of the trial, including Oney's, quote, official, unquote, 2003 book, the Atlanta Brayman Museum's 2008 Leo Frank exhibit, and the 2009 ADL-endorsed PBS docudrama, The People vs. Leo Frank. Yet the 83-year-old Alonzo Mann clearly believed that he had experienced the utterances firsthand. A few months after his reemergence, Mann was asked by his own attorney, John J. Hooker, to reiterate the experience, and Mann added quite a bit more to the tale. Quote, when I went to the courthouse, there was at least 500 people in the street, and they were saying to each other, kill the Jew, kill the Jew. Some had pistols. Some had knives. They were crazy. The brandishing of weapons is an embellishment that is unique to Mann's account. Even Frank's lawyers, in all their many appeals, never claimed weapons to be part of the proceedings, and never claimed threats were uttered or expressed. Anti-Defamation League attorney Dale Schwartz quotes his client, quote, Lonnie Mann said he was scared to death. People had guns in their back pockets. And when he got in there, Jim Conley was sitting at the table or something and gave him, as he put it, the evil eye and stared him down. So Alonzo Mann is lying, very much akin to a Holocaust survivor, so-called. Conley was not in the courtroom during Mann's testimony on August 12th. Conley had appeared in court the previous week for his own testimony and was returned to his cell at the Fulton County Jail. So the alleged stare-down is another invention of either Mann or his attorney. Mann said he did not remember seeing Wade Campbell, Corinthia Hall, Emma Freeman, Lemmy Quinn, or Mrs. Arthur White, all of whom were present at the factory office on April 26, 1913, the day of the murder. Yet he claims to have seen Conley 3 separate times, twice more than any other witness. When Mann arrived at 8 a.m., he says, he saw Conley sitting under the stairwell on the first floor of the building, direct quote. And later when Mann left, quote, just before noon, he saw Conley, quote, sitting where I had seen him when I came to work, in the darkened area of the stairwell, close quote. And yet a third time when he returned to, quote, catch Conley carrying the body of Mary Fagan. In 1982, Alonzo Mann described his first interaction with Conley on that Saturday, quote, he spoke to me. He asked me for a dime to buy a beer. A dime could buy a good-sized beer in those days. I told Jim Conley I didn't have a dime. That was not the truth. I had some money in my pocket, but I had let Conley have a nickel or a dime for a beer before. He had never paid me back. I didn't like to be around Jim Conley. After I told Conley I didn't have any money, I went upstairs to the second floor where my desk was located in the office of Leo Frank. Mann somehow remembers that at that early hour Conley, quote, had obviously already consumed considerable beer, close quote. But the specific testimony of one factory visitor named E.K. Graham, who saw Conley, was that, quote, if he was drunk, I couldn't notice it. And Graham's sighting would have been 4 hours further into the alleged drinking binge. Ivy Jones saw Conley on that day between 1 and 2 o'clock, and he swore, quote, he was not drunk when I saw him. Mann's new claim that Conley, quote, had women in there is a brand new revelation that has never been suggested by any other witness, not even by the factory's longtime employees or by his employer, Leo Frank. Mann's disdain for Conley's alleged misbehavior is not shared by the young white women who worked alongside Conley far longer than did Mann. They should have been scared to death of the, quote, vulgar and slovenly Negro sweeper, but Assistant Superintendent Herbert Schiff testified under oath that Conley, quote, was in the chain gang 2 or 3 times. Once he worked on Forsyth Street in front of the building, and then women would come up to me and try to get money to get him out 2 or 3 times. That has happened since he has been working at the factory. This is an extraordinary testament to the character of the black man that Mann and Frank's advocates insisted was universally disliked and feared. These young white women were willing to approach their own employer to seek funds to redeem Conley from a prison chain gang to return him to work with them at the factory. Graphic then of Tennessean newspaper's rendition of Alonzo Mann's claim. Guy watching a black guy drag off a body. Wholly invented. It is the third time Mann saw Conley that is the most troublesome. Mann says he came through the unlocked front door of the factory shortly after noon and spied Conley carrying Mary Fagan's dead or unconscious body. He further speculates, quote, from the direction Conley was headed and the attitude of the body that he was preparing to dump Mary Fagan down the trapdoor, which was at the floor level approximately 5 feet from where Frank's advocates alleged the murder occurred. The Tennessean provides an illustration of Conley carrying the body over his right shoulder whilst prying open the hatchway with his left foot, an eyeing man who looks on from behind. If this were the case, one must ask why Conley had lifted the body at all. Lifting 125 pounds of dead weight would be unnecessary for the stated task, and this makes Alonzo Mann's vision, quote-unquote, highly suspect. Even a drunk man would know that dragging an unwieldy load is far, far easier than lifting it, especially when the intention is to move a body to a hole on the same floor, just 5 feet away, with no intervening obstacles. Of course, one of the first clues the police detected was the visible drag mark on the basement floor that led from the elevator to the location of the body about 30 feet away, where the murder actually took place. Next section, star witness for the prosecution. Star witness, dot, 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 ellipsis, for the prosecution, question mark. Mann makes competing claims that conflict with Frank's longtime theory of the murder. Frank says that Conley laid in wait on the first floor for Mary Fagan to descend the stairs after receiving her payment in Frank's second floor office. Mann is very clear in his signed Tennessean affidavit of March 1982 about the location of this horrible crime. Quote, I am convinced that Mary Fagan had left the pay window and was coming down the stairs or had reached the first floor when she met Conley. But just a few months later, Mann is far less sure of that first floor murder theory. Quote, I never thought too much about that. He could have brought her down the steps because he was a strong Negro. He must have brought her down the steps. I never thought too much about that part. This, of course, is exactly what Frank's supporters did not want to hear Mann say, for if Conley were coming from upstairs with the body of Mary Fagan, then he was coming from the presence of Leo Frank, who had just paid Mary in his office. Those who insist that Conley committed the murder have a very small window for their theory to have any merit at all, and it absolutely requires that the assault be as far away from Leo Frank as possible. Any violent scuffle ending in murder could never have occurred in the second floor, just outside Frank's office, without his clear knowledge or participation. The autopsy revealed that Mary's death was a violent affair that left her with a blackened eye and a gash in the back of her head, with the ultimate cause of her death being strangulation, a lengthy process entailing much struggle, choking, and flailing by the victim. Yet they claim a drunken Conley accomplished the gruesome task noiselessly, presumably in a ninja-like fashion. So when Alonzo Mann, the only living witness to the actions on that day, theorizes that Conley, quote, must have brought her down the steps, he essentially explodes the murdered in the first floor theory and actually does more than any previous witness to implicate Leo Frank as the murderer. One can only imagine the glee of prosecutors had young Alonzo testified to this in 1913. Mann further falters when he describes Conley's relationship with Frank in precisely the way prosecutors portrayed it. Quote, Mr. Frank just gave him orders and he carried them out. Unquote. Further verification comes from ADL attorney Dale Schwartz, who confirms and reiterates Mann's account in Howard Simons' book, Jewish Times, colon, quote, Lonnie Mann, saw Jim Conley carrying the limp body, down the steps and into the main part of the factory, walking toward the chute to the basement. Last, the Frank defense actually advanced a theory of the crime that, yet again, is incompatible with Mann's claims. They say that Conley confronted Fagan on the first floor and pushed her to the rear hallway and murdered her there, not in the front vestibule. They say he then threw her down the back steps to the basement and followed later to strangle her and to finish her off. The defense's scenario, graphically presented in the August 12, 1913 issue of the Atlanta Georgian, is totally inconsistent with what Alonzo Mann now says he witnessed as he came through the factory's front entrance. End of that subsection. The new section, Man Overboard, colon, The Downfall of a Savior. A coalition of Jewish organizations, including the ADL, the AJC, American Jewish Committee, and the Atlanta Jewish Federation, arranged for Mann to tell his story in a question-and-answer session that was taped and transcribed on 10 November 1982 in Atlanta in the presence of two members of the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles. It was not a hearing in any legal sense. There was no swearing in or questioning by adversaries. Instead, the session was arranged with the stated purpose to, quote, preserve for all time the testimony of Alonzo Mann. But a review of the transcript reveals several problematic components of the session that undermine Mann's new claims. First, Mann says he was moved to come forward after reading about 30 pages of Harry Golden's book in the case, A Little Girl is Dead, quote, I saw there were so many mistakes in there and so many things that wasn't true, he says contemptuously. But Golden's book is an unashamedly pro-Frank book, and Frank partisans swear by its accuracy. Golden's first 30 pages, and the next 350 pages, for that matter, are true to the standard pro-Frank narrative, and, even so, Mann offers nothing to correct those so many mistakes, quote-unquote. Mann attempts to explain away his withholding of evidence in 1913 that might have saved Frank's life with the very dubious claim that the police did not ask him, quote, any direct questions about anything important except what I did. No one asked me anything in regards to that. Not only is that patently untrue, the police had no other purpose in communicating with him except to ask him about the murder, which occurred in a place where he had been only moments before. And as will be shown, investigators interviewed Mann several times about his knowledge of Mary's murder, but Mann withheld evidence, even committing perjury, a serious felony. As stated, Mann testified at the trial of Leo Frank on August 12, 1913, but provided no useful information about the murder. When asked about that in his 1982 session, his answer is indeed strange. Quote, "At that time, that was all I knew. I told it all." Unquote. So this guy is either lying or has been bribed or is confused or some combination of all those 7 years later. Mann claims that Conley threatened to kill him and that that frightened him into silence for 69 years. But in his 1982 retelling of his alleged encounter with Conley, he says that immediately after Conley's death threat, quote, "I took a couple of steps up and I saw the door was locked or shut and I didn't go on up. So I turned around and went out the door and went home." This is an extremely odd reaction by a person who had just come upon a murder scene with a murderer in the process of murdering. And the, quote, "locked or shut" door is altogether anew and contradicts all previous claims. A few minutes later, Mann's attorney reminds him that he once told a far more explicit story and then reads to Mann his previously sworn affidavit. Colon, quote, "I turned and took a step or two, possibly three or four steps, up towards the second floor, but I must have been worried about whether the office upstairs was closed. I did hear some movement upstairs, but I can't be sure who was on the floors above. I was fearful that the office might be closed, so I turned back towards Conley. I wanted to get out of there quick. He got to within about 8 feet of me. He reached out as if to put one arm or hand on me. I ran out of the front door and raced away from the building." End of the direct quote. The witness confirms that is correct. Mann clearly had lost an incredible amount of detail in a matter of a few months, details that must be read to him for him to recall. The attorney questioning Mann, John J. Hooker, is unable to elicit responses from Mann that synchronize with the affidavit. Hooker then takes over the session, providing both questions and answers on Mann's behalf. He simply reads Mann's previous affidavit, quote, "testimony," unquote, and then asks him to confirm its veracity. Still, Mann betrays a faulty memory. Quote, Hooker, quote, "He could have dumped her down the empty elevator shaft." Mann, "No, he couldn't have if the elevator shaft wasn't." Hooker, cutting Mann off in mid-sentence, "I understand, but the affidavit said he could have dumped her down the elevator shaft." Mann answers no, in quotes, but the attorney, John J. Hooker, insists that Mann should answer in the affirmative. Attorney Hooker is obsessed with establishing the drunkenness of Conley and leads Mann into a discussion of that, including this odd exchange where Mann resists committing to Hooker's leading question. Hooker, was he often drunk on the job? Mann, he was smart. He had a lot of sense, but it was the wrong kind of sense. Mann seems to have forgotten the conversation he says he had with Conley about his borrowing money for beer. He said in March 1982 that he had seen Conley, quote, "under the steps," and, quote, "obviously," unquote, drinking. When asked directly in November 1982, quote, "did you have a conversation with him," unquote, Mann responded, quote, "No, I just walked right on." The session arranged by the Jewish groups was designed to showcase for the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles their conclusive new evidence proving Leo Frank's innocence, but Alonzo Mann's faulty, erratic, unstable memory produced the opposite effect. The two members of the board who were present, of the five-member board, could only have been convinced that Alonzo Mann did not help Frank's supporters sustain their burden of proof. The board's refusal to grant a posthumous pardon to Leo Frank was inescapable. Next section, Alonzo Mann, quote, "afraid for 69 years? Alonzo Mann is presented in the Tennessean as a timid and obedient mama's boy who complied with the wishes of his parents and kept quiet about the murder and watched an innocent white man die for the crime of a negra, quote unquote. He said to the paper in 1982, colon, "I told my mother what happened, and she says, don't say anything about it, and we will wait and see how it comes out. So the next morning they find Mary Fagan, and my mother says, "Don't say anything about it because we don't want to get involved in it." The Tennessean writers worked hard to create the impression that man was gripped by fear, which prevented him from revealing the truth that only he knew. The article titled, quote, "Terrified Boy Feared for His Life," direct quote, by Frank Ritter, reinforces that idea, characterizing man as, quote, "paralyzed, fearful, and terrified." In the Tennessean's deliberately provocative racial imagery, quote, "Conley held her in a bear hug, his powerful arms wrapped tightly around her adolescent waist," direct quote. The writers would like the readers to accept that Alonzo Mann's white parents allowed a rapacious black murderer to return to the scene of the crime where their own child was employed, along with scores of white women and adolescent girls. Mann is goaded by the Tennessean to elaborate even further on that absurd scenario when he makes the pronouncement, quote, "From then on, whenever I was at work, I steered clear of Jim Conley. I kept away from him, and he did the same." Thus, Mann's parents allowed him to go back several times to a place where a child murderer was known to lurk, a murderer who had knowledge that Mann was the only witness to his lynchable crime. Whilst this fear seemed to silence Alonzo Mann, the young women in the factory, who had accepted Frank's suggestion that, it, quote, "a Negro was the murderer," evinced no such fear as they confronted Conley at work at the factory to accuse him of the crime to his face. Factory worker Mary Pirk, P-I-R-K, testified that she had directly accused Conley of the crime, whereupon, quote, "he took his broom and walked right out of the office, and I have never seen him since," she recalled. That closes page 448. And 449, there's Alonzo Mann's, a big graphic, a full-page graphic, Alonzo Mann's 1982 murder theory. The usual 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. Alonzo Mann enters. 2. Mann sees Conley carrying the body downstairs. 3. Conley sees Mann, threatens to kill Mann if he tells. 4. Mann leaves to go home. Next section on 450, Alonzo Mann's immaculate conversation with Leo Frank. Yet another inconsistent part of Mann's 1982 story is his stating that on the day of the murder, he had a conversation with Leo Frank in which he told his boss that he wanted to leave at 11:30 on the morning of the murder. Quote, "Mr. Frank agreed for me to leave at that time. I told him I would return to the office and complete my filing work later in the afternoon. He said he expected he would still be there." If true, Mann's statement makes Leo Frank a party to a conversation that his lawyers desperately needed and could have used to prove that Frank's encounter with Mary Fagan was not at all premeditated. Georgia State Prosecutor Hugh Dorsey maintained that Frank had hired Conley on Friday to guard the door for his anticipated encounter with Mary Fagan on Saturday. Frank's own day watchman, E.F. Holloway, testified that when he left the factory at 11:45 on Saturday morning, quote, "Mr. Frank said to me, 'You can go ahead if you want to. We will all go at noon,'" close quote. This testimony helped the prosecution establish that Frank was trying to clear the building for his intended sexual rendezvous that afternoon. So if Frank had expected Alonzo Mann to return during the afternoon, then Frank's attorneys could have more successfully, even convincingly, undermined the prosecution's attempt to establish Frank's motive. Leo Frank recalls every detail of his movements on that day, but not this exculpatory conversation with Mann, and Mann never mentioned it at the time when it would have been the most useful. Even if he were, quote, "afraid of Jim Conley," as he claims, his testimony of this conversation between boss and employee would have had no bearing on his, quote, "commitment," unquote, to Conley to remain quiet. Indeed, Frank's attorneys were so desperate for such evidence that they actually invented a similar scenario, which they added to Frank's version of events. During the coroner's inquest, 10 days after the murder, Frank suddenly, quote, "remembered that his foreman Lemmy Quinn had visited him in the factory at the exact moment of the murder!" Exclamation point. Incredibly, Quinn's memory returned to him at the very same time. That was almost certainly conspiratorial perjury, But there can be no question that if the conversation between Frank and Mann had occurred, Frank's attorneys would unhesitatingly have had little Lonnie confirm it on the witness stand. Further, Mann and the Tennessean would like us to believe that on a Saturday and a holiday, a 13-year-old boy who has the option of going to a movie, attending a parade, or returning to a factory to complete my filing work, direct quote, that his boss does not recall or expect him to do, would choose the latter. It's just not plausible. He'd be wanting, married, you know, to see the Confederate Memorial Day parade. Everybody would. That was taking place that Saturday. Next section, Mann versus Frank, irreconcilable differences. What Leo Frank did remember about Alonzo's presence on that fateful day creates an impossible dilemma for Alonzo Mann. The most consistent part of Mann's 1913 story is that he left the factory at 11:30 a.m. He says this to investigators on three separate occasions in May 1913, and then again a fourth time while under oath at Leo Frank's trial. But the defendant himself placed the time a full half hour later. Police officer W.W. Rogers investigated the murder and directly quoted Frank on Mann's departure time. Quote, "My stenographer left about 12 o'clock, and a few minutes after she left, the office boy left, and Mary came in and got her money and left." Hattie Hall is the stenographer in question, and she testified at the trial that, quote, "When I pushed the clock, it was 2 minutes past 12. And Frank emphatically concurred that, quote, "Miss Hattie Hall is an unimpeached and unimpeachable witness, and her testimony must stand," close quote. And here is where it gets impossibly tight for Alonzo Mann's 1982 claims, 69 years after Frank's murder conviction. Frank estimated that Mary Fagan left his office with her pay envelope after 12:07 p.m., If we are to believe Leo Frank and his carefully scripted, but often changing, timeline, Mary was then murdered by James Conley at about 12:10. If Frank's timeline is correct, and he was emphatic that it is, then Mann must have accomplished an impossible 16 to 19-minute sequence of activities within a 7-minute window between 12:02 and 12:09 p.m. before returning to catch, quote, "Jim Conley with a girl in his arm," unquote. Alonzo Mann's 1982 interrogators at the Tennessean obviously never knew that in 1913, Mann had told investigators several versions of his activities after he left the factory. The day after Mary's body was discovered, Frank hired the Pinkerton Agency to conduct the investigation on behalf of the National Pencil Company, and subsequently the Pinkertons interviewed Alonzo Mann three separate times, on May 6th, 7th, and 9th. Within a span of 4 days, Alonzo Mann gave three different stories about events that occurred less than 2 weeks before. And those stories conflict with his testimony at trial 4 months later. So Alonzo Mann is saying all kinds of garbage. And both the Pinkerton report and his trial testimony conflict with his latest tale in 1982. Why Mann was not more thoroughly investigated, given his differing statements, and why Frank's attorneys seem to have kept Mann's blatant inconsistencies out of the public eye, have yet to be explored. Certainly other employees were arrested or held on far, far less, or for no suspicious behavior at all. In his May 7th, 1913 interview, Mann is quoted using the language, quote, "I do not remember," or similar phrase, nine times. In 1982, he settled on this version, quote, "I was supposed to meet my mother that day about noon and go to the Confederate Memorial Day parade. When I left the premises just before noon, dot, dot, dot." His 12 noon meeting with his mother at the Vaudette Motion Picture Theater remains throughout all three Pinkerton interviews, but Alonzo's companion, quote, Philip, disappears in the first and third versions of his story, as does the visit to the barbershop and haberdashery, and his brother gets lost in his third version of events. In the first Pinkerton interview, Mann says he visited, quote, "a number of moving picture shows, But in the third, he says he visited just two. So this guy seems like to be an idiot or a liar. Mann mentioned his visit to Thomason's printing company in only two of the interviews, and he told Pinkerton investigators in the initial interview that he watched the parade, but does not mention it again in the second and third interviews or at trial. After 69 years, the reason for the 12 noon meeting changes. At first, the reason for meeting his mother was to buy a cap for himself, but in 1982, it was his mother's need for a hat that he remembers. So this guy is all over the map. He's not credible in any way, shape, or form. Below is a chart comparing the different statements of Alonzo Mann. The differing statements of Alonzo Mann. One must remember the effort that was made at the Frank trial to account for every minute and every movement of those in and around the factory on the day of the murder. This makes the inconsistencies in Mann's statements within a few days of the murder all the more perplexing. And then there's a page and a third of this guy being all over the map. Alonzo Mann, then and now. You got May 6th, May 7th, May 9th, all in 1913, and then in trial, August 12th, 1913, and then 83 years old in 1982, in March 1982, March 7th, and then November 10th, 1982, when he's 83 years old in those. And, I mean, you know, just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different statements. I mean, I'm not going to read through them, because you already have the idea how they, I mean, it's very amazing that a couple weeks after all this happened, he can't get his story straight and tells essentially three different stories. So this guy does not have credibility, Alonzo Mann. Picking up the text again, bottom of 454. Despite the boy's many conflicting statements, investigators apparently never questioned Alonzo Mann's mother, brother, friend, barber, haberdasher. That's like a hat supply. Harry Truman was in haberdashery before he became president, got into politics, or theater staff. So they never looked into this guy at all, but he was all over the map with his statements. In a case where minutes and seconds were so significant and critical and were argued over in court, in the press, and by historians, hence, it is an incredible oversight for the original investigators to have not followed up on the discrepancies of Mann's many stories, and an even greater blunder for those who promote Alonzo Mann as having solved the murder of Mary Fagan. Then there's a graphic, bottom of 455, taking up about three-quarters of the page. The Travels of Alonzo Mann, colon, his 1913 claims. Inset picture of him. In 1913, Alonzo Mann gave differing accounts of his movements on the day of the murder. He said he left the factory at 11:30 a.m. and visited these locations, but that he did not return to the factory. And then another inset of him as an old man. In 1982, Mann claimed he returned to the factory, saw Conley carrying the body, and, quote, turned around and went out the door and went home. He appears to me to be one of these weak minds who fantasizes stuff and can't get anything really clear in his head, and maybe he wants to be a little bit important. Who knows? A lying, confused, weak young man and a lying, confused, weak old man is how I would sum it up. And the graphic just shows all the different places. Atlanta Gas and Light Company, Bijou Theater, Thomason Printing Company, Barber on Viaduct, JPL and Hat Sale, Vaudette Theater, all these within blocks of the National Pencil Company, 37 South Forsyth Street. New section, The Cunning Leo Frank and the Disappearing Alonzo Mann. Question, this is an epigraph. Where did she go when she left the office? Answer, I heard her footsteps dying away. Leo Frank's sworn testimony before the coroner's inquest. In his carefully scripted, lawyer-reviewed statement about his own movements on the day of the murder, Leo Frank does not account for the departure of Alonzo Mann. Exclamation point. Right after the murder, Frank tells investigators that Mann left the factory after Hattie Hall left at 12.02 p.m., and he describes the arrivals and departures of every employee he had come in contact with on April 26th, except James Conley, of course. But at Frank's own trial, Alonzo's departure is unaccounted for, and no one, not the police, prosecutors, or press, seems to have noticed. And further, Frank let slip some mysterious language on the witness stand that suggests a new role for Alonzo Mann. On page 182 of the brief of evidence, Frank recounts his actions just moments before Mary Fagan arrived. Quote, Miss Hall finished the work and started to leave when the 12 o'clock whistle blew, and actually didn't. She left the office and returned. It looked to me almost immediately, calling into my office that she had forgotten something, and then she left for good at 12.02 p.m. Then I started in, we transcribed, first we enter all the orders into the house order book, Defendant's Exhibit 12, all these orders which Miss Hall had acknowledged, I entered in that book. Leo Frank twice used the term, quote, we, in reference to work he said was performed before, right before Mary Fagan arrived at 12.07, by his accounting. He used we before he reverted to using the first-person singular pronoun, I. Later, Frank and his lawyers produced a timeline in which Mann's presence is acknowledged, but his departure time is unaccounted for. This may have been a calculated oversight. Frank and his team of lawyers wanted to give the jurors the impression of a bustling and well-trafficked office, and imply that Frank was not alone when Mary came to collect her pay. Frank makes other subtle suggestions of an active factory workday, even though he and Mary were now the only known ones to be on the second floor, the only ones known to be on the second floor. Frank testified to the coroner about Mary's visit. Quote, this little girl who was killed came up and got her envelope. I didn't see or hear anyone with her. I didn't hear or speak to anyone who might have been outside. Who, quote, might have been outside, unquote, is not disclosed. But by Leo Frank's own account, it, quote, might have been, unquote, Alonzo Mann. These incredible conflicts of testimonies concerning the whereabouts of Alonzo Mann vis-a-vis his employer so close to the time of the murder should have piqued the interest and the attention of the state prosecutors, but those differing accounts have never fully been examined. In light of these unresolved scenarios, the, quote, nervousness and trepidation, fear and anxiety, unquote, Mann had exhibited during his appearance at the Leo Frank trial, may very well have indicated a covert, unspoken role on the day of the murder, says NOI. End of that section. Next section, the Tennessean joins the Frank propaganda team, the newspaper, 1982. From the beginning, the advocates for Leo Frank have had the benefit of a cooperative press to bolster their cause. The New York Times, under Adolf Ox, almost single-handedly repackaged Frank's depravity and sold it to the entire world as Frank's martyrdom. In 1982, the Nashville Tennessean, under John Siegenthaler, stepped forth to fill that crusading role to declare Frank's innocence in a crime that had troubled the Jewish world for 69 years. And then on 458 is a full-page graphic of the Tennessean story. An innocent man was lynched, and they have an artist, direct quote from the caption, an artist interpretation that we described earlier of Conley carrying the body, of the confrontation between Alonzo Mann, then 14, and Jim Conley holding the limp form of Mary Fagan on the first floor of the National Pencil Company. Headline, an innocent man was lynched. It's a big lie. Siegenthaler had no intention of bringing a fresh critical eye to a perplexing cold case. His single-minded objective was to exonerate Leo Frank, who I'm going to guess is a fellow Jew, Siegenthaler, and pin Mary Fagan's murder on James Conley. And that caused the Tennessean to abandon any trace of journalistic ethics. It neither questioned nor pursued any of the blatant discrepancies, obvious conflicts, and confused fantasies inherent in Mann's many stories before accepting his, quote, confession, unquote, entirely at face value. And further, the paper regurgitated to a brand new audience the very same glaring falsehoods, fabrications, and diversions that had plagued the case for a century, nearly all of which had been handily debunked almost as soon as they appeared, in 1913 to 1915. Yet they reappeared unchallenged in 1982 as if they were new revelations. Kind of reminds you of Hitler saying that you would argue with a Jew, and even if you very rarely got him to finally admit that he was absolutely wrong, the very next day he was right back to arguing the first thing that you rebutted. And Hitler was amazed. He said, I didn't know whether to be more amazed by, I can't remember the two, but just the way they had lied, and then they would go right back to their original story, even when they were defeated. The Tennessean reporters borrowed heavily from the piles of pro-Frank perjuries generated by the nefarious alliance of the William J. Burns Detective Agency and Adolph Ochs's New York Times. In one of the sloppiest pieces of journalism on record, the Tennessean recycled so many of these long-dead myths and lies that it requires a chart to catalog just a few of them. And they take up most of the rest of our space today with that. But with these we will read through. Just as modern journalism is just a bunch of Jewish lies. To get one of their guys out of a 100-year-old conviction. Now, Nashville, Tennessean on trial is the title of the chart, : Falsehoods and Fictions in the March 7th, 1982 edition. So the Nashville, Tennessean puts out this as described edition that repeats all the old lies that have been rebutted for decades, for 70 years, that were rebutted right when they were first put forward by the lying Jews. Now they're repeating their lies 70 years later. And we'll go through them. The trial kindled the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. False. The D.W. Griffith movie, The Birth of a Nation, which debuted in 1915, was the impetus for the KKK reemergence. The Frank case sparked the formation of the ADL. False. Though the Frank case gave the ADL a powerful promotional symbol, the ADL, a division of the B'nai B'rith, had already been formed in Chicago before the murder of Mary Fagan. The Knights of Mary Fagan was a secret order whose avowed purpose was to avenge Mary Fagan's death. False. The group is a New York Times invention. Frank's lynchers never used that name. And again, the shouts of crack the Jew's neck and damn Sheeny that were heard in the courtroom alerted Jews throughout the world that Frank's religion was a substantive factor in the case. The jury was deliberating in a mob atmosphere with crowds jamming the streets shouting anti-Semitic slurs. A wave of rabid anti-Semitism engulfed Georgia, and there was a mounting sentiment against Jews. The trial was conducted in a frenzied environment with shouts of kill the Jew. The trial surrounded by mob hysteria and violent anti-Jewish sentiment. Outside the courtroom, the gang had shouted hang the Jew. Fires of anti-Semitism swept Atlanta during the trial. During the trial, there were frequent catcalls of kill the Jew. False. Even Frank's most avid supporters have dropped those false charges from their latest writings. On to page 460. Jews in Georgia were openly ostracized in the aftermath of the Frank trial. Jews were expelled from some towns. Others were forced to lock their doors and board their windows. In the months following the Frank lynching, half the 3,000 Jews in Georgia left the state. False. Not a single Jew was expelled from anywhere in Georgia as a result of the Frank case. The Kristallnacht scenario simply never happened. Though Georgia blacks continued to suffer lynchings and burnings alive, the Jewish population actually grew in the years after Frank's lynching. Next, the Jews who remained in Atlanta were crippled financially by a massive boycott of Jewish businesses, as Jewish residences were boarded up, and as women and children of Jewish families were sent out of the state for their safety. False. There were no boycotts of Jewish businesses, which in fact thrived before, during, and after the Leo Frank affair, 1913 to 1915. The single known attempt to boycott never materialized. There is evidence that Jewish merchants boycotted Georgia, as did the New York firm of L. Heim & Sons, which refused orders from Georgia, quote, until we are satisfied that law and order has again been restored. Next, the ADL, aided by the NAACP, became vigorous in opposing all lynchings. False. The major NAACP anti-lynching initiative was its energetic support of the Dyer, D-Y-E-R, anti-lynching bill in 1918. There is no record of the ADL's involvement in this anti-lynching effort. ADL literature appears to be concerned with but one lynching in American history, that of Leo Frank. Frank's attorney, Louis Marshall, head of the American Jewish Committee, and at the time, he was the number one Jew in America, openly opposed the Dyer bill and successfully worked to destroy it. Next, at least three persons later were quoted as saying Conley confessed to them he was the killer. False. James Conley always maintained that Leo Frank was the killer of Mary Fagan and that he was called upon by Frank to help him conceal her body. Conley never, quote, confessed, unquote. Next, violent men gathered at the state capitol, armed with shotguns, rifles, pistols, and clubs. Among the some 5,000 gathered here, many were spoiling for fights. Close quote. False. After claiming that men brandished deadly firearms, the Tennessean then claims that they only, quote, hurled insults, then rocks, bottles, and other missiles at the home of their governor. In fact, the Atlanta Constitution reported that 1,200, quote, noisy demonstrators were at the governor's residence after he commuted Frank's sentence to life in prison, and they were quickly dispersed by guards. Quote, many arrests were made, but none of the properties of the National Pencil Company, its management, Leo Frank, his family, or his well-known Jewish supporters were ever touched or even threatened. Again, these are all lies that were printed in the 1982 edition of the Tennessean. Again, armed mobs roamed the streets of Atlanta for days as Jewish store owners closed their businesses and hid behind boarded-up doors and windows. False. There is no record, report, or testimony of such activity. This description more accurately refers to the 1906 Atlanta massacre of blacks, wherein for several days, white mob mayhem occurred that included the murder of 50 blacks, the wounding of 150, and over 1,000 forced to flee the city. Again, Judge Roan disclosed to friends that he believed in the defendant's innocence to have been proven to a mathematical certainty. Direct quote. False. Judge Leonard S. Roan never professed any doubt about the verdict and reaffirmed this when he denied Frank a new trial and imposed the death sentence immediately after the guilty verdict. Next quote. Frank's trial attorney, Luther Rosser, quote, strolled in and out of the courthouse, ignoring the shouts of, "How much are the Jews paying you, Rosser?" False. This story appears to have been made up by author Harry Golden, who in his book, A Little Girl is Dead, adds that the attorneys were, quote, tripped and, quote, spat on. There is no mention of it by Rosser or any other member of Frank's massive legal team. Next lie, prosecutor Hugh M. Dorsey was not hesitant about using questionable legal tactics. False. The Tennessean gives no examples of the alleged questionable tactics, and no illegalities were claimed in the many court filings of Leo Frank. Frank's operatives, on the other hand, committed numerous illegalities in their attempt to free Frank and frame Newt Lee and James Conley. Next lie. Two jurors made anti-Semitic statements. False. Investigation showed this claim to be unfounded. See section herein titled Leo Frank's Pardon and Crucifixion. Next lie, Judge Roan pleaded, quote, pleaded with the governor to commute Frank's death sentence, unquote. False. Judge Roan died in March 1915, 2 months before the governor's commutation. He had suffered a debilitating decline in his health for months before he died. Next lie, quote, cinders were found under her fingernail showing she had clawed the ground in her struggles. False. No testimony was given by the coroner to this effect. Quote, it became apparent the elevator did not go to the basement that day. False. Testimony and physical evidence show that the body was moved by way of the elevator from the second floor, Police found drag marks on the basement floor that led from the elevator to the location where the body was found. Again, all these lies are in one edition of one newspaper story, essentially, or one edition. And they all support Leo Frank's lies and his side. Next lie, Conley had been sitting on a wooden box, quote, soliciting those passing by for nickels with which to buy more beer. False. There is no testimony that this happened. Three people said they saw James Conley, Mrs. White, E.K. Graham, and O. Tillander, and none claimed they were ever, quote, solicited for anything. Next lie, Frank, quote, did not know Mary Fagan. False. Frank at first claimed he did not know Mary, but ample testimony from co-workers and Frank himself proved that he knew her and had had conversations with her. She was one of four young women who worked on his floor every day for about a year. Next lie. Frank had never met Dalton, and he certainly would never have allowed loose women to be brought to the factory. Direct quote. False. C.B. Dalton, a white man, gave strong and convincing testimony that he and Frank engaged in sexual encounters with, quote, loose women at the factory as Conley stood sentry at the door. Next lie, the murder notes were created in the basement, not in Frank's office, and were solely Conley's doing. False. Frank's attorney, Henry A. Alexander, was found to have altered data on the factory order form to fit that false theory. Next false claim. Journalist Pierre Van Passen claimed that, quote, teeth marks were found in Fagan's body and that they did not match Frank's dental records. False. No such photos or dental analysis exists. Next lie. Conley wrote indecent letters to a jail employee named Annie Maud Carter, and he confessed to her. False. The so-called Carter letters were the fraudulent creations of Frank's hired detective, William J. Burns. Carter denied their authenticity and swore that in her conversations with Conley, he always maintained that Leo Frank was guilty of murdering Mary Fagan. Burns and his agents were indicted largely on the basis of those letters and a host of other criminal operations. Next lie. The term night witch in the murder notes refers to a Negro legend, and Frank could not have known this. False. This legend is actually a German fairy tale, and Frank was a German Jew. In fact, the phrase in the notes was a deliberate misspelling of night watch and referred to the factory's black night watchman, Newt Lee, the man whom Frank first tried to implicate in the murder. Three more lies. First, Conley confessed to several persons, quote-unquote. Slayton, quote, knew that Conley privately had confessed to the crime for which he blamed Frank, unquote. False. Conley only confessed to helping Frank move the dead body of Mary Fagan after Frank had already killed her. Lie. A dice or card-playing Negro witnessed the murder. Utterly false. Freeman, quote-unquote, was never identified beyond his surname, even though the stated informant was Atlanta physician J. Calvin Weaver, who served as surgeon for the federal prison where the confession was allegedly made and where Dr. Weaver would have had direct and clear access to Freeman's full name and legal history. And final lie. Judge Roan issued a letter exonerating Frank from his deathbed. False. The letter was a clear forgery that emerged from the ranks of Leo Frank's defense attorneys 2 months after the judge had died. Judge Roan's family and his pastor repudiated it. So the story that appeared in the Tennessean is completely made up of lies. 3 pages of them, as recorded here when we've just read through. Now 2 more pages to go. Many of the above Frank case falsehoods are in Robert Sherborne's article titled, quote, Evidence Paints Janitor as Real Killer. Sherborne raises the thoroughly repudiated charge that James Conley had confessed to his attorney, William Smith, calling it the, quote, most compelling, unquote, of all his, quote, proofs, unquote, against Conley. Thus, it is a measure of the quality of the Tennessean spread when the best refutation of its most compelling claim comes from William Smith himself. In the very press conference in which Attorney Smith announced his new epiphany about the innocence of Leo Frank, the Atlanta Constitution reported, quote, Mr. Smith took pains to state to reporters that Conley had made no damaging admission and that nothing the Negro had secretly said had influenced his new opinion. In the end, the 83-year-old Alonzo Mann represents not his own memories, but the wishes and desires of his handlers. His total embrace by the Nashville Tennessean and the major Jewish organizations, the ADL, B'nai B'rith, the American Jewish Committee, and the Atlanta Jewish Federation, reflects their desire to inflate the elderly man's credibility for no other reason than to better exploit him. And when one confronts the elaborate scheme to graft Mann's fictional chapter onto the Leo Frank affair, it quickly collapses in the light of the facts of the case and the inability of their elderly hero to uphold key elements of the story. Mann's dubious, quote, recollections are not genuine memories, for they conflict irreconcilably with those held by the man whose reputation and legacy Mann believed he was trying to save, Leo Frank. Last, it is important to consider what may have driven Alonzo Mann out of the dark after 69 years of silence on the matter of who killed Mary Fagan. Mann's own lawyer, having assisted in setting up that disastrous private hearing in 1982 in front of members of the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles, revealed something far more significant than his client ever divulged. John J. Hooker disclosed that behind the carefully scripted Alonzo Mann, quote, revelation, unquote, is a book and movie deal executed by the two main Tennessean journalists, quote unquote, Robert Sherborne and Jerry Thompson. Hooker said that those two newspapermen, quote, would be in control of the Alonzo Mann story, unquote. Turns out that Mann had entered into a written agreement with those two gentlemen, unquote. Despite the claim of the conscience clearing after 69 years, it appears Mann was induced to come forward because of clear publicity and monetary enticements. And then to close out this session, at the bottom of 464, we have posthumous pardon timeline. So all this stuff decades later, here's how it went. So March 4th, 1982, Alonzo Mann, in failing health, signed an affidavit asserting Leo Frank's innocence and Jim Connolly's guilt. He admitted he had seen Connolly carrying the limp body of Mary Fagan on his shoulder near the trapdoor leading to the basement on April 26, 1913. That was March 4th. On March 7th, the Nashville Tennessean ran a special supplement with the story of Alonzo Mann's confession, which bore the headline, quote, "An innocent man was lynched." And then a few months later, in November, Alonzo Mann repeated, November 10, 1982, Alonzo Mann repeated his story in a videotape statement in Atlanta. And then January 4th, 1983, so 3 months later or 2 months later, based largely on Alonzo Mann's testimony, the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Committee, and the Atlanta Jewish Federation, Inc., submitted to the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles an application for a posthumous pardon for Leo Frank. And later in that year, August 8, 1983, Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles hears case for Frank pardon. December 22, 1983, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles denied the motion for a pardon because while Alonzo Mann's testimony might incriminate Jim Connolly, it did not conclusively prove the innocence of Leo Frank. March 11, 1986, last one, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles finally issued a posthumous pardon to Leo Frank on the basis of the state's failure to protect him while in custody. It did not officially absolve him of the crime. And that will end the penultimate session here. And, you know, just astonishing how this group, the people of the lie, will live up to their name. And they'll continue to lie and suborn false testimony decades after the fact. And they'll continue to use complicit Goy newspapermen. Those are Goy names that wrote that garbage in the Tennessean, in order to exonerate falsely their own. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll conclude the Nation of Islam's The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man.